Welcome to another edition of Simons Says, a podcast devoted to conversationalists and the curious-minded. Here's your host, me, the follically challenged Dave Simons, certified financial planner and all-around nice guy. So it is January of 1996, and I am starting my new investment show called Dollars and Cents. Can't believe it's been that long, but it was on this new radio station way down on the left side of the dial, 550. Those people in St. Louis know it as KTRS. And one of the ways that the program director wanted to promote the show was to put me on briefly a few minutes every day talking with this guy and his team known as the Large Morning Show. And I didn't really want to do it at first, and I'll tell you why. Turns out the other guy didn't really care about it that much either. But I knew the head of this Large Morning Show as Franco Pinion, and I knew it wasn't a show for me. It wasn't my show because I knew Franco Pinion as a country guy. He was always on country stations. Now, he had a brief stint, which we'll get to, on a classic rock station in St. Louis, but mainly it was kind of country-based. The show may not have been, but I didn't know that. I thought, well, I'm not a country guy. I don't like country music. I'm a rock guy. Franco Pinion would tell you, as he did later, I don't know if I want some boring finance money economist guy kind of disrupting the flow of the show. But somehow we made it work. And here we are almost several decades later. And the guy is sitting in my, as part of a guest of this Simon Says podcast, because not only did we make that work from a business relationship, but we also got to know each other as acquaintances and friends and welcome Franco Pinion.
Thank you.
Do you have any recollection of that at all?
97 is when I started.
So I started the show in 96. So then about a year later, must have been. Because if I remember right, I think that started over in Illinois at WIBV.
I wasn't part of that.
Strange
thing. They bought, 550 was KSD AM. These people bought it after they had tried to make their investment group work on a signal in Belleville, which was a disaster.
That's what it was, yes.
Nobody could hear it, and they had hired a bunch of KMOX people. It was a long story. So they moved them over to Belleville, instant death. So wisely, they purchased 550 because the owners didn't want it. They bought a group of stations, and it was just extra baggage. They didn't even want it. And I was already on there and was basically told, do whatever you want because we don't really care about this signal. So just knock yourself out. So I did, and they purchased it. And then they brought me in 97 to what had become no longer KSDAM, but KTRS.
Right.
So there you go.
So I want to start with what you're doing now, and then we're going to go back to kind of the beginning because I know you have a lot of fans. I've already had a couple of people email me knowing that I was doing a podcast, and I'm not kidding. They said, we want Franco Pinion on there. So what are you doing today?
I'm not working. I'm out of work. I'm not retired. It's nicer. It sounds better to say you're retired. I'm out of work. Our show was removed. In fact, in 10 days, it'll be 2 years ago, was removed from 590, which is where I was for the last 3 years of my career. We were taken off because a consultant told the new owners, you want to be an all sports station, and you want every piece of programming to be sports. I'm not a sports guy. I'm not a political guy. I'm not embarrassed to say this. I've said it on the air many times. I know less about more than anybody I know. I don't know any. I'm not a knowledgeable person. I'm just not. I'm not a well-read person. I read bits, pieces. Not if you put a big book in front of me, John Grisham, I'm not going to read that. I'll watch a documentary. I love documentaries. So I do snippets and bits and pieces. I'm selective, but I'm not the person that sits down and reads a book or two every week. And the guy who ran KTRS when they purchased that signal didn't want me. He was a KMOX guy, and he fought it and fought it. And everybody said, my goodness, he's already on that frequency. People know who he is. This would be a big mistake. They wanted another KMOX. This town doesn't need another KMOX. One's enough. And it took other people to to convince him to bring me in. And I was there 20 years until I quit 5 years ago and walked out and left a really good job and good money. But sometimes you got to do what you got to do. And then I went to 590 for 3 years and we were removed. Funny, the guy who suggested to the new owner that they be all sports has since been fired long ago. Mm-hmm. And he's somewhere else out of town, ran him out on the rail. I think he was stealing from the station. I don't know, but that's what I heard. So it's funny, the guy who gets us kicked off is kicked out. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how well they're doing. It doesn't matter to me.
But you would go, if someone came to you and it was the right mix, like you said, you're not retired, you'd go back on.
Absolutely, I would, but it would have to be, I'm very particular. It would have to be laid out in every aspect, the marketing, sales, support, social media, everything. How are you going to promote our show? Because if you don't promote our show, people are not going to know we're on. So there's, people say to me, why don't you buy a radio station? Well, first of all, if I bought a radio station, I would own a radio station. I'm going to work 60 hours a week because it's going to have to be right. I don't want to do that. I'm too old for that. I don't want to do it. But if somebody came to me and said, we bought a radio station, we want you on in the afternoon. We'll start. That'll be our anchor show. Okay, let's just work out the details. And yeah, I would do that. 4 days a week, though, not five.
That's right.
Last 5 or 6 years of my life, I only worked four days a week. It was great.
Right. You know, one thing that you always say, which intrigues me, is you don't have a lot of skills.
I know.
You don't know a lot.
Like, I know.
But I always, I'm going to push back on that because everybody has skills. Everyone has a talent. I think you know you have one.
I have a skill for telling a joke and a story, but I don't have a lot of knowledge.
Okay. Well, fair enough. Well, yes and no, because I've heard your show for many, many years, and I know you guys would do some trivia stuff. Now, Dan Strauss is a guy who doesn't have a lot of knowledge. All right, I'm going to call Dan. I love you, but you weren't always good with that stuff.
But he doesn't need a lot because Dan also has the skill. His skill is being Dan Strauss.
Yeah, right.
And that guy in the room that everybody loves to be around.
Yep.
And we all know somebody like that, that when they're in the room, nobody dislikes them. And it's hard to go through your life and have it said that nobody disliked you. Mm-hmm. I don't know I've never heard one person say they didn't like Dan. And for those who don't know, Dan was with me 25 years, I guess. And the first call I would make if I went back on would be to Dan. That's my first phone call.
But getting back to your skill, you're a conversationalist. Right. You know how to tell a story. You do. There's nobody better.
I will not. I'm not going to sit and act like a, well, I do.
No, you do.
I will agree.
You are, and telling a joke and your memory of telling a joke. And it's fascinating when you look back, that's how it all started for you. It's not, people need to know, Franco Pinion didn't go through childhood saying, I want to be a radio host.
Never.
I want to grow up. I'm going to go to college and go to broadcast journalism school. I'm going to learn all the skills. And then I just happen to be on and I'm a funny guy. Nothing could be further from the truth. How did it all start for you?
Okay. When I was a teenager, the show, the station was KXOK. KXOK played the top 40 rock. And I get in that car. But like lots of people, I listened to that radio station, and it was my music and my station. But that's a lot of people say. I never once listened and thought, I'm going to do that, ever. Like a lot of people, my parents did not support, once I made the decision, I want to take a look at this radio thing, not only did they not support it, they just kind of turned on me. And their dream was for me to be a doctor, you know, and I considered being an optometrist. In fact, I went to school just enough to realize I don't want to be an optometrist because here's the job of an optometrist. No offense, optometrists, we need you. But you walk in every day and you turn on the fluorescent lights and the first patient comes in, you put the thing up on the wall and you go, okay, read the third, and hold this over your left eye, right eye, and they put that big thing in front of you. Is this better? One, two, two, one. Every day, that's what you do all day. And I just thought, I don't want to do that, even though it would be a thrill to be a part of having somebody for the first time ever see clearly. Because I remember what that was like. I was in fifth grade, and I got my first pair of glasses, and wow, did I need them. But it's not something I want to do every day. And so what happened with me was I decided that I was intrigued by radio, but never, ever thought I'll be on the radio because I don't have the voice for it. To me, you had to be one of those people.
Yes. And I'm, hello,
not,
everybody.
I'm not that guy. I'm just a regular voice. And there was a time when you needed that voice to get in the business, but those days are long gone. Look at Jack Carney. Jack Carney had a fairly high but conversational voice. He didn't have an exceptional voice. He just knew what to do with it. So I tried to go to college, didn't work. I got the long story. I got suspended, kicked out, probation, and never finished college. But while I was on the campus of SIU, Edwardsville, while I was there, struggling, trying to be a student, but not really trying, they were in the process of putting a station on the air, WSIE FM, 88.7, still on the air. And they were building the studio. And a friend of mine said, you want to go down to the communications building, look at this studio? So I went with him. And we went in the basement, and here's a tape recorders and microphones and turntables. He said, sit down. I sat down, and I put a Beatles record on. Here are the Beatles. And I hit it. And I thought, wow, people make a living doing this. And even though I didn't end up as a disc jockey playing music, it still intrigued me. So I was able to get a part-time job. Actually, when WSIE went on the air September 4th, 1970, at 6 o'clock in the morning, that's when that station went on the air. The second voice heard was mine.
You, wow.
6 o'clock guy came on. I came on at 10. It's the worst thing you could ever hear because I was hyperventilating. I thought I was going to pass out because you assume everybody's listening. Nobody's listening. It's a campus station. 10 people are listening to you. But
now, did you still have, you're from Tennessee.
Right.
You said you had an accent.
Had
did you have
a horrible accent.
Even then, when you first started in 1970, yes. Did you still have that
yes.
Tennessee
yes.
hickey accent
yes.
thing? Yeah.
I tried to mask it as best I could, but it's still there. You can't, you know, when you're from the hillbilly sticks town of Tennessee, you talk like this. This is exactly how I talk. I've got a tape at home when I was 15, and this is exactly how it sounds. It all the words fell out of my nose. And I remember I took a course at SIU. Man, I wish I could remember this guy's name, but I don't. And it was a public speaking course. And I remember the first day of class, he went around the room, got everybody to stand up, state your name, why are you here, blah, 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 blah. And I stood up, and I said, well, I'm here because I think I'd like to look into getting into radio. After class, he asked, he said, can I see you for a second? And everybody else walked out, and he said, are you serious? And I said, yeah, I'm serious. He said, and do what? He said, unless you can find a part on the radio for a hick, no offense, a hillbilly, what are you ever going to do? I said, well, that's why I'm in here. Get you to help me. Help me talk right. So he did. He wrote down some words, and there were a lot of WH words, wherever, whomever. He said, you talk through your nose. It falls out of your nose. You have to blow the words out better, like out of your mouth and your diaphragm or whatever. So I would go down and you could rent a booth with headphones and a reel-to-reel Wallensack tape recorder. And he made a tape for me and he said all the words on the list. And he said, you repeat them until you learn to say them. It sounds more like the way I sound. And so I did that every day, just over and over and over and over. And very gradually. Now, the funny thing is, Frank Opinion is a fake name. But when I started it, I went back and deliberately picked up a little bit of that Southern accent. Not as nasally, but more of a Southern Texan kind of a thing.
Yeah, right.
Because I thought, and I was right, when you initially go on the air, you need something to make people go, listen to this guy. He doesn't sound like everybody else. So my choice was to have a bit of a Southern accent. And I did it. And I did it for years. But then very gradually, I got tired of it because when I would go meet people or do an appearance, I had to, nice to meet you, I had to remember, oh, I'm the guy with a Southern accent. Don't lose it. But over time, I just very gradually got rid of it. And do you know that no one ever even noticed or mentioned it? Nobody ever says, hey, didn't you have kind of a Southern accent? Because it was so gradual. And over such a long period of time that I lost most of it. There's some still there. It's still there. I know there is. But not enough to bother anybody. And I also don't need it anymore. So
you're on the air. Your first job is 1970, is 70, that right?
Yeah.
At the Edwardsville station.
Right.
And then what? You drop out of school.
Quit. I went back long enough to show them I wasn't stupid because I had failed and failed. I'd been literally expelled, kicked out. I asked for a meeting with the dean of the communications department, and I begged him, give me a third chance. And they did, and they made the rules very tough. Normally, you got to come in with a C average on probation. They said, we're going to make it a B. If you don't do it, you can never come back here again. And I got the B average, and then I quit. I just wanted to do it long enough, one semester, to show I wasn't stupid. And I left. But I left to take a job at WRTH Radio, which was 590, oddly enough, the last place I worked, full circle. And it was a beautiful music station. Percy Faith, Henry Mancini, all the crap I didn't want to listen to, but it was a job. And my primary job was writing liner cards for the people who actually had the voices to read. Tomorrow night at 7 o'clock, the Women's Auxiliary of the VFW will hold a chicken dinner. I wrote those for other people to read. And then one day I got lucky, and the production guy said, hey, I got to produce a commercial. Can anybody here do an old man? And I said, I can. And he just looked at me and goes, you? I said, uh-huh. You know who Walter Brennan was? Nobody under 50 knows who Walter
Brennan. Oh, of course I do.
Walter Brennan was a very famous actor, and he had a TV series called The Real McCoys. And Walter Brennan, in his 30s, looked and sounded like an old man.
Yes.
So my old man was nothing more than, an impression of Walter Brennan. And that's how he sounded. He kind of grunted when he talked, and I went in and did it. And the guy goes, that's unbelievable. He says, can you do, and then he says, here, I got a part for a young guy. Hi, Mr. Johnson. Did you want to see me? And he goes, this is incredible. So I thought maybe, even though I don't have an announcer voice, maybe I can do character voices. Mm-hmm. And when it was all said and done, with 8 years in the agency business, I did voices for at least 2,000 commercials.
Wow.
I used to go out to Merritt's. Merritt's did a lot of training films. And I would go out and Kentucky Fried Chicken was a big client of theirs. And all their training audio cassettes were done at Merritt's. So they called me out, and they had a part for a trainee. And I remember one of the lines was, Mr. Johnson, Mr. Tommy, whoever the boss is, I said, Mr. Johnson, I have a question. He goes, yes, what is it, Tommy? When at the end of the day, sir, what do we do with our potato salad that's left over? Do we just put it away and serve it again tomorrow? Oh, no. Oh, no, no, we never. And that was what I did. And it paid pretty well. Every time I walked in there, it was $400 or $500 there for an hour. I did several of those. I became sort of a spokesman for J.I. Case. They make heavy bulldozer. I don't know one thing about that stuff. But when you're reading, and I'm telling you that as a farmer, you need to take a good look at the Case 560 diesel dozer. This will change your life. And they go, wow, it's great. I don't even know what I'm talking about. I'm reading, and the hydraulic hose fitting is an XT5. It's been improved since last year's XT4. And you guys know what I'm talking about. That thing was a bear to deal with. I did numerous J.I. I even did a film, J.I. Case, where I'm jumping off a trencher. They had to teach me just to shut it down, drop the bucket, and hop off. Like I just finished digging. Big tree. I didn't dig it. But at the end of the film, and prior to this, all you had heard was my voice voicing over footage of this equipment. At the very end, there I am in a flannel shirt, and I hop, I'd give anything for a copy of this. I hop down off that thing after I shut it down. I go, well, there you have another job well done by the Case 560 diesel trench, whatever it's called. And I just remember, man, I wonder if anybody watching this who's an actual farmer or construction guy looks at this and goes, guys, no idea what he's doing. They just taught him how to shut it down and jump off. And I don't know the answer to that, but look good to me.
But what this is so interesting to hear.
This could go for 5 hours.
And I did not know that part of your story, doing all these voiceovers at the beginning of your kind of your radio career, because that makes sense to me now. Knowing how good you are and how successful you were for your advertisers when you're even at the very top. And I just thought, if I owned a fledgling company in the St. Louis area, I would hire this guy in a second. You, unlike anyone I ever heard, would tell, you would tell a story. Okay. You wouldn't just say, no. You should buy this product because they sell great barbecue sandwiches.
Well, you just mentioned, can I give you an example?
Exactly.
I'll give you an example of a business that I'm going to say our show saved, when in fact I saved it, but it sounds a little egotistical. Bandana's Barbecue, the owner, oh my goodness, this is 25, 30 years ago.
Yeah, back in the 90s.
Called me and said he listened. And he said, we have a barbecue restaurant in Arnold, and we're dying. And he said, we're not going to make it. We need help, and I think you're it. He took his personal credit card, and whatever he had left on the card, he used to pay for whatever amount of schedule that would buy. And it might have bought him 6 or 8 weeks or 2 months. I don't know. And I remember what I said to him on the phone. I said, I'm going to come down there, and I want you to serve me just one little serving piece of everything you make. And if it's just another barbecue place and a run-of-the-mill, I can't help you because there's nothing exceptional to talk about. So I went in there, and I had a little bit of everything. And I remember before I left, I said, yeah, we can do this. But I had also told the audience that I was going to be going there. I said, I just let them in on the very beginning. I've been called. I said, so I will let you know. If you don't hear from me about this place again, it's because for whatever reason, we weren't able to put it together. I wasn't going to say because it's crappy food.
Right.
We just weren't able to make it work. And I was able to come back on and say, I am proud to say, yeah, we're going to talk about this place because it's worth talking about. They went from one location. By the time I stopped working for them, and that's a story we don't have time to go into. It's not that it didn't end well. It was bought out. And,
right.
And a lot of times when somebody buys something, they want... It's all their way.
Put changing your own thumbprint on it.
Yeah. So by the time I finished, I think they had 15 or 16 locations in a relatively short time from one, simply because the listeners knew that I was never knowingly going to sell them something I didn't really like. You know, Johnny Londaw, Chevrolet, been around forever, big supporter. He'd be on the air tomorrow if I went on. If I'm going to talk to you about Johnny, I'm not going to start by saying right now, Johnny Londaw of Chevrolet, save like never before. I hate that line. Mm-hmm. Save like never before. Hey, first 100 callers will get. I don't do any of that. Here's how I would start. I'd say in 1962, the only new car my dad was ever able to buy, and he agonized over the payment, was a 62 Chevy Bel Air, AM radio. Three on the tree, three on the column. I mean, it was a basic, basic car, but to us, Cadillac. And I remember when we rode in to the lot in his 53 Ford and they were washing my dad's new Chevy, I thought he was going to have a heart attack from fear of the payment and excitement. And my brother and I were giddy. We couldn't wait to get in it. And that's the experience to me that everyone should have, especially now when they buy a car. It shouldn't just be another transaction sign here. The dealership should understand how excited you should be and how happy they are for you that you got a new car. Even if your newest car is a used car, it's still your new car. And that's the way that I do commercials. I don't
always.
I cannot stand. Ask my wife. I watch TV now. And I see the commercials, and out loud, I'm talking to them.
I bet you are.
Because let me clue people in on
your
something.
Poor wife.
Let me clue people in on a couple of things. One, we have this 99 mentality in retailing, which drives me nuts. I filled up my car yesterday, and it was $399.9. That is 0.1 cent. Less than $4. If the guy across the street has gas for $4 and they see the three,
mm-hmm.
That's where they go.
Right.
To save a 10, which means on 10 gallons of gas, you saved a penny. It's stupid.
Right.
$89.99. That's $90. In fact, it's $93 or $4 or $5 because tax. Okay. $199.99. That's $200. But The marketing and advertising world has realized how stupid and gullible people are. Here's another one. And if you're one of the first 100 callers, you get a free blanket. Well, they didn't say only the first 100. I promise you, if you call that number 3 days later, they go, yep, You got in on time. You were the 6,000th caller. They didn't say only the first 100. They said the first 100 callers. Well, the first 100 will get a blanket. And so will the second 100. Yeah. And here's the other one. When they're gone, they're gone.
Yeah. Well,
of course. How ridiculous is that? But people buy into all that stuff and offer while supplies last. Well, supplies will last as long as you make it.
That reminds me of a comedian once said, I forget who this was. I saw him on Carson. And he said, you know, my mom used to always say, well, I've been searching for my keys, and wouldn't you know it, it's the last place I looked. Well, of course it's the last place you looked.
Yeah.
You don't keep looking after the last place you looked.
I've tried to stay away from all the things, the cliches, all the advertising, little gimmicks.
Call my friends. That's the one that bugs me.
Oh, I can't stand
that. It's like, just so you can call my friends today. They're not your friends.
You barely know them. You had a meeting with them to sign a deal to do the commercials, and maybe you'll see them once every 3 months. Yeah, they're not your friends at all. I've never, ever used that line. Go see my friend Johnny Londo, even though he is a friend, because it sounds hokey to me. Maybe not to everybody, but if it sounds bad to me, then I don't want to do it. And so I choose to just tell a story. And I can't really think of, well, let's take a heating and cooling company. I think, you know, the best way to start a commercial like that is not to ever, and never ever would I do this. It's the best place to buy a car. And I don't know that it's the best, but I don't know anybody better. There's a difference. Mm-hmm. There's a big difference. We are so spoiled. If our air conditioning goes out and it's 100 degrees, when can you get out here? Now, most every heating and cooling company will say, and we have emergency service and we'll get to you right away, but maybe, maybe not. It's not so much about that. It's with any business, what I want to know is who am I working with? It's the people. I don't care about the company name. When that guy comes to my house or that woman comes to the house, if she's courteous, polite, respectful, knows what she's doing, I don't care what name was on the truck. I don't care if there's another one. Oh, it's another. Since 1939. Well, you know what that could mean? You're tired and you've done it so long that you don't really care anymore. That doesn't mean anything to me. You could have, in fact, if you opened a month ago, you're hungry and you want business and you want word of mouth. I'll go with a new guy. I told my boys who are in the restaurant business, I said, here's my advice to you. I said, I don't know anything about the restaurant business, but I helped them get started. And I just said, I got two pieces of advice. One, make sure those restrooms are always clean. Women especially do not want to go in a filthy, wet paper towels on the floor.
Oh, isn't that true?
Keep that thing shining and spotless. And I said, and the other piece of advice, every day. And by the way, anybody listening starting a business, this holds true. I don't care what kind of business it is. To me, act like every day is your first day in business. Because if you've ever been to a place, grand opening, before you leave, how was everything? Tell your friends, please come back. Was everything all right? Thanks so much for coming, because you are not sure if you're going to make it. Act that way every day. If you've been in business 15, 20 years, when they come in to eat, thank you so much for coming. Was everything okay? Please come back. Tell your friends. We'd love to have you back. Thank you. Try to keep that.
And you developed a reputation for having the integrity to also turn down offers, right? You don't need to mention a company, but I'd love to hear an example
I'll give you an example.
You said no to.
I'll give you an example. There have been 100 of them. This was an all-day trip for me. I went to a nice guy and a great place, but it wasn't what he wanted me to tell people it was. It was Mark Twain Lake. And he has a series of there are cabins there, and there's a general store. And he wanted some of the Lake of the Ozarks business. And he said, if you'll come up here, Mark Twain's not exactly down the road. It was a full day. He said, if you'll come up here and just take a look, I'd like for you to consider speaking for us. So I went up there. I spent the whole day there. At the end of the day, he said, what do you think? I said, I can't do this. I can't speak for you. He said, what do you mean? I said, well, you want people to go to Lake of the Ozarks to come up here to Mark Twain Lake. Mark Twain Lake is a fishing lake. That's all it is. Your cabins stink. They are great cabins for two guys who want to belch, smoke cigars, drink coffee, and clean fish. But no family is going to want to come and stay in one of these cabins. Your general store, I said, while I was here, your generator, which powers the whole general store, went down twice and the store went dark. I'm not sending people here. Now, if you want me to go on the air and say, hey, guys, or gals, want a place to fish and scratch your butt and belch and drink coffee, and I got it, and smoke cigars in the cabin, I got your place, Mark Twain Lake. You want that? I can do that.
Yeah.
Not what he wanted. He had that business. He wanted to expand, but he didn't have, and I was afraid the guy was going to punch me. You know what he said to me? He said, thank you so much for not just taking my money.
Mm.
Yep. And I said, I don't do that.
That's what I said, the reputation that you've got and the integrity. I do want to go back to what your calling card is and the ability to tell a joke.
Right.
Now, what you had talked about leading up were doing the voiceovers and the characters and all that. Tell me when it first happened, the first time you got on the air and you told a joke and all of a sudden the angels were singing in your head going, I think I got something.
Changed my whole life. At 1984-85, KUSA, I worked at KSD-FM, a show called Morgan and Crunch in the morning. I was just a gopher, a grunt, a producer. I would get on the phone and pretend to be people. I have the sheriff of that Alabama county on the phone right now. Are you there?
Yes, sir, I'm here. I understand you're talking about a story down here.
And I was that voice. It wasn't really that guy at all, and most people could figure that out. But I was just a bit player, and down the hall was a country station, KUSA, and they were struggling as an understatement. They were 15th in the market in the morning. And too bad, because they had a great host, Lee Sherwood, and Robert the Country Fox, both passed away. And general manager who was over both stations came and got me one day and said, would you be willing to come down the hall just 5 or 10 minutes every morning and try to shoot some life into this show? And I said, how would I do that in 5 or 10 minutes? She said, I don't know, but you got this character on the other station, Ed E. Torrio, who was a takeoff on Robert Hyland. That's another long story. Maybe you could come up with a character for this country station. And I don't care what you do, just anything. Just come in there 5 or 10 minutes and give it something. On a Sunday night, and I was to go in Monday morning, I came up with the name Frank O'Pinion. I called one guy. His name is Dennis Kreps, Outdoors Ned. Because I knew he was creative, even though he was a graphic arts guy. He's very creative. I said, Denny, what do you think about this? Frank O'Pinion. Immediately he said, I love it. I think it's great. So between that and my thinking, it sounded okay. I walked in Monday morning. Lee Sherwood is the host. I said, Lee, did they tell you I was coming in? He said, yeah. He said, that's about all I know. What are we doing? And I said, well, I don't know. I said, but I will end it with a joke because that's always a good way out. No matter what else is happening, if you bail with a great joke, that's what they remember. He said, okay, how do I introduce you? And I said, Vice President in charge of commentary, Frank O'Pinion. Now, to Lee's credit, after the 8 o'clock news, I think is about when it hit, about 10 after 8, he hit a sound effect of a creaking door. He said, oh boy, basement door open. I believe we're going to get a visit for the first time from our vice president in charge of commentary. I don't know how important he is, but it couldn't be very important because he's got a basement office, and I've been down there. Ladies and gentlemen, Frank O'Pinion.
That is good.
And
that's
very clever. Well, I said, and I had that sort of southern accent that I deliberately had, and I said, well, Lou, he said, it's Lee. I never, in the whole time I was there, called him. That's another thing you do to make people pay attention and actually remember his name is Lee. By messing it up. And I said, well, you know, Lou, he said, it's Lee. I said, yeah. They've asked me to come in here, and we talked a little bit. And I said, do you like jokes? He said, well, sure. I love them. Well, I got one for you. Now, he also had the forethought to get a joke needs an end. It needs a rim shot or laughter or something. If you watch, that's the reason sitcoms have fake laugh tracks. You need to hear other people laugh, or you need to know it's over. Boom, boom. I said, hit something. I'll point to you when I'm about to hit the punchline. So he did. And I don't remember, it was a rim shot or whatever it was. And I mean, when I walked out of there, I could see it on his face. He was so happy to have me in there. And I felt needed and I felt welcome. And we did it the next day and the next day and the next day. Within 2 or 3 weeks, the general manager called me in her office, and on her desk was a pile of letters from listeners. More frank opinion. Mm. So I begged them to let me leave the FM and just go down and be with Lee and Robert, because they actually appreciated what I did more than the other side. And I got to be careful here. Sometimes there's a jealousy and a resentment that happens when you make more than the boss, when you are more popular than the host. Not with Lee and Robert. They were thrilled to have me. So I went down the hall and begged them. They wouldn't do it. It took 6 months of begging. And finally, they saw what I saw, that forget the FM. It'll be okay, but we can take this. We took that thing from 15th in the market within 18 months to second after KMOX in the morning. I mean, we were on fire. Mm-hmm. We had a road show that would go out and perform a full show. I didn't do most of them because I have stage fright. But if they threw enough money at me, I would go. And the people that had the money with you, bring Frank with you. Let him come out and do something. Okay. And I never felt bad about getting more than the other people because I made it clear. I don't have to do it, but if I'm going to do it, you have to pay for my upset stomach. You have to pay for my stage fright. And you have to pay me to be that uncomfortable. But once you walk out, within 30 seconds, everything is okay because they're there for you. You can't really do anything wrong unless you get up and you're drunk and you insult. I mean, it doesn't matter what you do.
People listening right now are probably yelling, Dave, did you hear what he just said? You got to ask him about this. You just said stage fright.
Yeah, tremendous stage fright.
Which is really going to confuse people because of who you are.
But it
and
shouldn't.
You talk to thousands and thousands of people.
But I can't see them.
So that's the difference for you.
Right, I can't see them. They can't see me. I don't like being looked at. I don't like attention. I don't do luncheons, banquets. I would if somebody's got a lot of money and they want me to do it. You're going to pay again for my upset stomach, my 3 days of living in the bathroom and second guessing myself and running through in my head, what can I do to not fail? The truth is, if you're in front of an audience that you're there because they asked you to be there because of they know you and they listen to you, you really can't go wrong. But it took me a long time to realize that, and I had tremendous fear of failure. Even though I never, in hundreds of guest appearances here and there in what 15 minutes or an hour, never had a failure but once. And it was a call from a doctor that I knew. There was a meeting, like some kind of 2 or 3 day seminar of a group of doctors from all around the Midwest. And he said, at the end of it all, we have a banquet. Would you come and pretend to be my guest as a doctor from anywhere? Doctor, pick a name. And I said, I can't do that. And that would scare me to death. They're not listeners. He said, no, you'll be great. And he kept offering me money, and they're doctors. They got money. So finally, and if we're honest, at a certain point when somebody hits a number.
Yeah, right.
Okay.
Yes.
So, right. He introduced me. He says, I'm happy this evening to bring a good close friend of mine. Went to medical school together, Dr. Jerome Gilliam, or whatever my name was. Please, from Memphis, Tennessee, please welcome him. The doctor's. You know. I said, thank you, Phil. I said, now before I went in, I asked him, I said, pick me out a couple of people and just tell me something. Well, there was one guy there who was like the country's leading proctologist, okay? I said, it was a real pleasure to, they still think I'm a doctor. I said, to meet you, Dr. Schomburg, or whatever his name was. I said, I know all about you and your proctology practice. I'm sure you'll understand why I didn't shake your hand. Dead silence. Absolutely. And I thought, uh-oh, this is what I've always been afraid of. Yeah. And then I thought, okay, recover. The guy who asked me to speak was a very well-known allergist, a great allergist. And I said, I turned to him and I said, my friend of many years from medical school, I cannot thank you enough for your hospitality. I said, folks, this man took me out in a Jeep earlier today and gave me an extensive tour of his ragweed farm out in West County. Now, that would mean he's creating allergy. He has a ragweed. Mm-hmm. Silence. Not even a snicker, nothing. I thought that was about the best line I had. He has a ragweed farm. And I almost wanted to stop and go, hey, hey, get it?
Yeah.
The wind blows west to east, and the ragweed is making everybody have allergies. So if you have to do that, you're dead. Yeah. And then I remember, all I remember is one other thing. I said, I thought I was going to have to get up here and apologize for being late because I drove around this place 3 or 4 times. And I didn't think that could possibly be the right place because the park, judging from the parking lot, I thought this was a Mercedes-Benz dealership. Doctors, silence.
Oh, my God.
And I don't know how it ended, but thank goodness at some point it ended. And I stepped down and I got the check and it bounced. And I thought, okay, this is a clear message. But it really was just a mistake. Yeah, and they did send me a good check. That's the only, I mean, absolute failure.
So while you were up there, could you feel the anxiety? Everything you feared was happening?
I thought I was going to throw up while I was up there. But there'd be doctors there if I did.
Right.
That's the only failure. Out of hundreds, we went to KUSA had a road show. Road show was all the personalities on the air, and they all did something. Sang, danced, played with a fake puppet, and we had a band, the Rusty Halo Band out of Litchfield, Illinois. They were great. And I remember we were hired to go to the DuQuoin State Fair, big fair. And I'm scared to death. I don't know how many people there'll be. I was afraid we'd look at 2 people, 3 people. We're backstage, and the crowd is all standing. It's a fairgrounds, so they're standing. And there's a highway patrolman, and he's walking backstage going, Franco Pena, where's Frank? Who's Franco Pena? Where's Franco Pena? I said, that's me. I thought, what have I done? And we just got here. He said, could you follow me, please? And I said, am I in trouble? He goes, I don't think so. And I followed him over to a temporary, like, trailer. And that was where the office of the head of entertainment programming was for the DuQuoin State Fair. Her name, I believe, was Pat. And the officer said, Pat, this is Franco Pena. She stood up. She said, you're Franco Pena. I said, yeah. Am I in trouble? She said, not at all. She said, can you hear, just listen to the arena over here to your right. And it was music. She said, that's Crystal Gayle and Eddie Rabbit, two at the time of the biggest names in country music. She said, they drew 3,000 people. You drew 5,000. Mm. And I just wanted to see what it was, who it was, that would get that kind of a crowd here. And I said, well, I'm sorry to disappoint you. Exactly. This is it.
Right.
And she shook my hand, and we went back over, and I walked out, and there are 5,000 people already, as soon as they said, Frank Opinion, screaming. And I thought, what must it be like to be Garth Brooks? What must it be like to walk out in front of 100,000? I mean, my goodness, overwhelming. And I remember that night, the only thing that could have gone sideways, the other thing that happens when you're spontaneous and you do everything, is you test your ability to think on your feet. And in that crowd, there was one guy drunk with a Casey shirt on, T-shirt. And he's yelling, and I'm in the middle of a joke. KC rules. And I just go on. And finally,
I stopped drinking after that night. So I apologize. Okay. You know that.
Actually, his name was Bob. I do remember that, and because I asked him his name, and I just stopped the joke, and I said, "Excuse me." I said, "Let this man come forward." He came right up to the stage, and I said, "What's your name?" He goes, "Bob KC rules." And I said, "Well, Bob, I'm going to do you maybe the biggest favor anybody ever did you." I said, Bob, turn around and look at these people. They're not here for Casey. They're not here to you yell, Casey. They're here for us. And you're disrupting the show. But I'm going to, rather than be upset or have somebody, you know, I'm going to do you a giant favor. And I said, ladies and gentlemen, would you, and I just asked the audience to part and leave like an aisle in the middle. And I said, I'm going to give Bob here 30 seconds to run out of here. And if he doesn't make it to the back, beat him up.
That's so brilliant.
I said, 29, 20. This guy looked around and saw, it's not a joke.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was a track star. He ran like you've never, and as he's running, a couple of people like kicking his butt as he goes out. And then when he gets out, everybody applauds. And I said, so now the guy goes in the bar. I just finished the joke. But that's what I remember from the DuQuoin State Fair.
Yeah.
And there have been a lot of moments where I could have gone down in flames. But the other thing that I've learned is if somebody calls you and it's a live show and they're tearing you apart, maybe unjustly, but just let them go. Let them go. They'll run out of gas. They will eventually run out of gas.
So your show, and we talked about this beforehand, you are the original Seinfeld in terms of it's a show about nothing.
Well, that's beyond a compliment I don't deserve. I love Jerry Seinfeld. Even though I met him, he was a jerk.
Right.
But he's brilliant and he's clean.
Yes. But you would not have before a show, okay, here's my outline, gang, let's get together. I got these nine things that we're going to talk about.
You know what I have on one piece of paper? I have the commercials I have to get in that I do, a first hour, Johnny Londoff, Matheny Heating and Cooling, whatever, second hour. And I made sure I got those within that hour. Other than that, if you want to call and talk 20 minutes, let's talk. We'll get the commercials in later.
I've heard before a guy would call in and it would be such an interesting topic. All of a sudden, an hour and a half later, you guys are still talking about what that original guy called in about. You can't plan that.
No, and I refuse to work on it's called a clock. Most radio people have a clock. It's actually a circle that the program directors think you need, and it's sectioned like a piece of pie. 8 minutes of this, 2 minutes. I will never do that. Tell me the commercials I need to get in, and other than that, we get the news in top of the hour, and we're good to go. But I will never bail on a compelling phone call. Had a guy on one day who lived in St. Louis and had the world's largest collection of harmonicas. He had 5,000. He didn't play the harmonica. He didn't know how to play a song. What a great interview. And to me, stuff like that, what's missing, look, anybody can play music. Nothing against music stations, but come on. Music's on your phone, even your car. What's missing is fun and just clean, harmless fun. It starts with a joke. That's the best example.
And that's a great segue, because if there was anything planned in your show, you know it's centered around the joke.
Every day when I went in, I had a joke in my head. That's the joke I'm going to do today. That was really all that was in
stone. And how did that come in the morning? Did you have it planned out on Monday? Here are the five jokes I'm going to tell Monday?
No. Every day. Just every day on the way in. Usually on the way in. Mm-hmm. And I kind of had in my head a good feel for how long it'd been since I told that joke. I don't want to tell a joke if I've told it within the last year, if I can help. The funny thing about jokes is I could sit here and tell you 100 jokes right now, and you may have heard them, but you will have forgotten them. And you go, oh, yeah, but you don't remember. And when you hear it again, it's like you heard it for the first time.
And then you'll forget it again.
Yes.
Except for you.
A year later, you hear it again. It's still funny.
And then you forget it again, and everyone who knows you, that's the thing that they'll say. It's like, how does that guy, one of the people who aren't familiar with Frank's show, one of the funny things that you guys used to do, somebody would call in and say, Frank, got a joke for you. And then what was the sound effect? Yep.
Shotgun.
It was a shotgun. Because if you knew the joke, you were going to quickly say the punchline before then, he got to then, it, and then bam, shoot him.
Rarely. Did I not know the punchline.
And I would just go, the caller would start the joke. I'm like, I know that joke. Let me see.
But how does
that
end? You can't think of the ending.
But you always knew it. And you say that your memory is shot.
It is.
Except for that.
My memory is gone.
How do you explain that?
I don't know. But there have been a few people in my life, their goal, and these are personal friends, their goal was to tell me a joke I didn't know. Most of them never accomplished it. Mm-hmm. I'll give you two examples of people who did. And one is Dennis Krebs, the guy I mentioned earlier who I called about the name Franco Pinion. He called me one day and said, I think I finally got it. I got one. And I said, all right, let's go. So he tells me this joke. And as soon as he told me the joke I'm about to tell you, I thought, oh my goodness. Not only was I not upset that I didn't know it, I was thrilled. Nothing excites me more than a good mass appeal joke that's not filthy or vulgar. You don't need those words to tell it. You could change it. But a great joke that I didn't know. It's like Christmas. Mm-hmm. So as soon as he told, here's the joke. He said, the guy, now I've taken it and made it better, but this guy's a businessman and he's out of town on a business trip. And tomorrow morning at 8:00, he has the most important business presentation of his entire career. This is going to put him over the top if he makes this sale. So he checks in the hotel and he opens his bag. He brought his best suit for the presentation at 8:00 in the morning. And as he opens it to hang it up, there's a giant rip I mean, like a foot long in the crotch of the pants. And he has no idea how it got there. How could this have happened in packing? I don't remember. He's beyond upset. And he looks out the hotel window, and across the street is a tailor shop. It's about 10 till 6. Closes at 6. And on the sign in the window, it says, Murray Fink. What do you think? I mend clothes for free. Do you know this, Joe?
I have heard it.
You know the ending?
I know. See, that's my point.
So he runs out of the hotel, dashes across the street, just as Mr. Fink is turning the sign from open to closed. He bangs, Mr. Fink, please. And Fink opens the door. He says, yeah, can I help you? He says, Mr. Fink, I know you're closing, but my goodness, I have a crisis. I saw your sign, Murray Fink. What do you think? I'm in clothes for free. Boy, do I have a mending job that's important. And he tells him the whole story. The sales at 8 o'clock in the morning. And my, please, please, can you help me? He goes, well, you know, I'm closing. He goes, I know, Mr. Fink, please. Let me see. He looks at it. He goes, well, that's quite a rip. He goes, I know, I don't even know how I got it. I can't possibly wear these pants like this. Can you make this right? Yeah. Leave them with me. Be here at 7 o'clock in the morning. Oh, thank you. He can't sleep. He can't wait to get 7 o'clock. He's there. Murray Fink shows him the pants like they were never ripped. The perfect job. He says, my goodness, Mr. Fink, I don't know how to thank you. Thank you so much. He turns to walk away, and Murray Fink says, but not so fast. He says, what? $395. He says, what? He says, that's what you owe me. I took the pants home. I work them late. I open early for you. $395. He goes, wait a second. What about the sign in the window? He goes, what about it? He says, look at Murray Fink. What do you think? I mend clothes for free. He goes, no, you're reading it wrong. It's Murray Fink. What do you think? I mend clothes for free? Now, this is where you need.
Yes, exactly.
What do you think? I mend clothes for free?
And as you were getting close, it did come to me. And I thought, oh, it's the motto. It's the way that you say it. Now, then I remembered it.
I had a friend who died from ALS, the cruelest disease ever. I visited him every week for the 2 years he had it. Was with him when it started in one finger, and the last time I saw him, he could only blink. It's a horrible disease. But his goal before he died was to tell me a joke I didn't know. He's a police captain, 9th District of St. Louis. And he called me one morning, and he said, well, he says, I'm a left-handed shooter like you. I'm a gun guy. I got a lot of handguns, and he knows I like to shoot and pretty good shot. And he says, I said, what do you mean? He goes, well, I went to the range and qualified. I couldn't squeeze the trigger with my right finger. He says, I'm only 49 years old. My goodness, I got arthritis or something. It was ALS. He didn't know. He said, but I managed to squeeze off enough to qualify with my left hand, so I'm a lefty like you. He said, but I hope it's just temporary. Get in there and get it fixed. Next time he called me, he broke down crying. He said, I have ALS, and I maybe have probably 2 years. I don't know, but he said, I'm going to die. Before he died, when he could still barely speak, he was very halting. He said, I think I have the joke. And I said, okay, Tom, go. And he tells me the joke I'll tell you now. And it thrilled him. It thrilled me. And I'm always honest. I was not going to pretend that I didn't know it if I knew it. I can't do that. It's just not part of me. If you start to, I'll go, and then she says, that's my husband.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. Sorry. I couldn't help it. So he tells me this joke. And the joke is, guys looking through the young people, there was a thing at one time called the want ads in the paper. And you'd go there to find a car or a puppy or whatever. And on social media, you got eBay and Facebook Marketplace and all that. But this guy's looking and something jumps out at him and it's a dog for sale. 6-year-old German Shepherd, highly trained, speaks perfect English. And that kind of jolted him. And he thought, well, come on. That's a pretty good little marketing place. He calls the number. And he said, I'm calling about the German Shepherd. He said, is this a typo or is it $25 for this highly trained German Shepherd? He said, that's right, $25. And he says, what's the part about speaking perfect English? He says, well, you just have to come over and meet him. So the guy goes to the address. Guy opens the door, and over sitting by the fireplace is a beautiful German Shepherd. And the dog looks up and says, I guess you're here about me. Now, the guy's first reaction is, okay, this guy's a ventriloquist. Yeah. He's throwing his voice somehow. But then he soon realizes, no, this dog is talking. And the dog says, come on over, have a seat. Have a seat here by the fireplace. What do you want to know? And the guy is just stunned. He says, well, I can't believe you talk. He goes, yeah. Well, that's the least. What do you want to know? I don't know. Tell me, what, you 6 years old? He goes, yeah, 6 years old. He goes, look, here's what I think is going to be important to you. I'm a licensed, trained seeing eye dog. I've worked with the FBI. I've been overseas, Iraq, Afghanistan. They took up a couple of bombing sites, trained to sniff out anybody who might be in the rubble. So blind people, dead people, barely living people. I've done it all. I've seen it all. I worked multiple police departments that brought me into their canine units to help, so their other dogs could watch me because I was the best at what I did. That help you? And the guy looks at the owner and goes, for goodness sakes, how could you sell a dog like this for, why would you sell him for $25? And the guy says, because he's a liar. It's a great joke.
I don't know if I had heard that one, actually.
It's a great, because he's a liar.
Yeah, yeah.
And it thrilled, when I burst out laughing, he could tell I didn't know that joke.
But the cleanliness of that, I even hate to bring up Bill Cosby because eventually what he became.
Right.
But I was always the biggest fan because he was so good, but clean.
Like Seinfeld.
And like Seinfeld. I've seen Seinfeld a couple of times. In fact, I saw him on Carson in 1984. It was his first appearance. And then I happened to want ads, but anyway, I'm looking at, and it says, Jerry Seinfeld recently seen on Johnny Carson coming to the Westport Playhouse. This was in 1984.
Ooh.
And I went and saw him, and he was terrific. No cussing.
Still terrific. Still no cussing.
And so it can be done.
It can be done. Yes, it can. And unfortunately, if you, let's take Sirius satellite radio, you go to the comedy channels, 90% of it is just absolutely filthy.
And you don't have to.
No.
You could eliminate the F-bombs and the GDs and all this, and still it could be a great joke.
Right.
So why do they do it? Just for shock effect?
I don't know.
Is that what it is?
It would be... One thing, if you were the only, Howard Stern in his early days, if you're the only one doing it, ooh, but now it's everybody. You're just doing what everybody else does and what I guess they rely on or some kind of crutch, thinking that maybe if they don't do it, they're not going to attract. I don't know. I'm confused by all of it.
But with that said, you would occasionally, maybe you didn't think so, but some people thought you would go up to the line, even cross over. I assume that you had some listeners or people who wrote letters going,
oh, sure.
Or maybe to the GM or whoever, and say, you need to get him off the air. He's vile. Did that occur from time to time?
Yeah. There's a joke that I told, I think, the last couple of years that I was on KTRS. It got one serious complaint. Now, I don't pay any attention to one or two complaints. A couple of dozen, probably represents a couple of hundred people. But the joke was, and there's nothing really offensive in it, I can tell you on this podcast, was dad has three kids, and his son comes to him one day and says, Dad, I've never asked you about this, but... We don't have names like other kids in school.
I know this.
You know this?
Yes.
Why is my name Feather? You want me to tell it?
Yeah, go ahead. We can always edit it. One of your great lines, we'll edit it later.
I don't think you'll have to.
Yeah, I agree. I don't think so.
And his dad says, well, son, he says, when you were born, we didn't actually went and picked out a name, so we left the hospital, and we didn't do that yet. And as we walked, your mom walked out of the hospital, a white feather from nowhere, out of nowhere, there's not a bird in sight, just drifts down and lands on your forehead. And I looked at her and we just said, Feather. And we named you Feather. He said, okay. Well, his sister steps up and says, Daddy, what about my name? Flower Petal. What kind of name is that? He goes, well, honey, he said, it's kind of the same story. We didn't have a name for you. We walk out, your mom leaves the hospital, and a beautiful flower petal just drifts down and lands on your head. Now, there's not a garden, a tree, a bush in sight. sign, maybe. We named you Flower Petal. And the third kid says, he goes, yes, what is it, Cinder Block? Now it's a joke.
Yes, it's a joke.
So this woman calls me, leaves a message. I return her call. She said, how dare you make fun of, and I said, of what? Of a kid named Cinder Block? It's a joke. It's not even a real, it'd be one thing if I said, okay, so this kid with cerebral palsy goes, no. I said, I'm sorry it upset you, but there's nothing about it that in any way is making fun of any sort of real situation. It's just a joke and a ridiculous joke. Now, this is going to fly by, so we eventually at some point need to get to men versus women telling jokes. Mm-hmm. It is a fact. This is not a sexist comment. This comes to me from women who tell me themselves, I don't know how to tell a joke. We don't have a lot of friends. I'm not a sociable person, but the very few couples we ever do go out with, this has come up on at least a dozen occasions. And the woman usually says, I don't tell jokes.
You remember we were out at dinner once and we had my wife try to tell, and you said the same. You actually complimented her. You said, that's actually not too bad.
She didn't do a bad job.
She didn't do a bad job.
And some women can, but most women cannot. And I picked out a joke, and it's my test joke for women or for anybody, but especially for women. It's a blonde joke. And the funny thing about blonde jokes, never ever have I had a complaint from a blonde about them. In fact, they tell me blonde jokes. Blondes do. Pollock joke, different story. That had to go because that was offensive. You just take the Pollock jokes, make them blonde jokes. And when I was on the air, I took the blonde jokes or any other joke, and if I was on AM, they became FM DJs, and if I was on FM, they became AM DJs. Mm-hmm. They were the butt of the joke.
No one's safe. Right.
So this particular joke that I use as a test, I would test it on you, but I know you'll pass the test. And it's simply this, a blonde, and keep in mind when I tell this joke, most of the women I've asked to tell me the joke back immediately, right after they heard it, can't do it. Blonde is walking down a country road, and coming toward her is a man with a like a burlap sack, big sack with a string tied on top of it. And she says to the guy, the blonde says, excuse me, what's in the sack? The sack is moving. What's in the sack? He said, honey, it's puppies. She said, oh, I love puppies. If I can guess, do you remember this joke?
No.
If I can guess how many puppies are in that sack, could I have one? He said, hey, if you can guess, you can have both of them. She says, five? Now, that's a funny joke.
And that's the kind of thing you could tell at Halloween, which is,
it's
30 seconds.
You can have both of them. Five? Now, inevitably, when I go, okay, tell me that joke back, most women will start like this. Woman's walking down the road. You've already blown it. It's a blonde. It has to be a blonde or it doesn't work. So they blow it right there. Or they'll get to the part and they just get lost. So if I guess there are two puppies. No. Right. They just start stumbling. And it's amazing because that's a really relatively simple joke to tell.
Have you figured out why? It's not that women...
No, I don't know why. My wife doesn't think The Simpsons are funny. She won't watch Dumb and Dumber.
Three Stooges,
funniest
all
thing.
That stuff.
Oh, my goodness, the funniest thing in the world. Ace Ventura, Pet Detective. She won't watch any of that. It's like she doesn't... It's not that she has no sense of humor. We're just not on the same... She'll catch me just laughing. What are you watching? She'll walk back. No, she just leaves the room. She doesn't think it's funny.
Jay Leno even did a bit on that saying, you ask men... Their idols in life, and they'll say, well, there's Abraham Lincoln and there's George Washington,
Mo
Curly.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah, I can see that. Women, not quite as much.
Now, I'll do one more. And these are just examples of jokes that most people screw up, and I don't know why, because they're simple. And this one is a kid who goes to his mom. He goes, Mom, why do the kids at school call me Big Head? Do I have a big head? She says, oh, honey, no. Those kids are jealous. No, sticks and stones, okay? Yeah, but it's not just one or two kids. It's like everybody, hey, Big Head, here comes Big Head. I must have a big head. She goes, no, now you stop that. Don't you let those kids do that to you. In fact, let's just change the subject. I need you to go down to Mr. Marshall's produce stand, and I want you to get me a bushel of potatoes. And he goes, okay, what am I going to put them in? She says, put them in your cap. Harmless.
So it is
simple.
It is so,
but you don't see it coming.
But here's one of the things you had these sound effects. That's what the other thing your show right. was known for.
Right.
And you had a couple of producers over the years, and they were all good. Sometimes it took a while, but once some of the replacement producers got in there and they got the
sound
effects,
once they kind of got the show,
yes, and then they could remember everything.
Right.
But one of them was passing gas.
Right. The universal funny sound.
And I thought about that, and I thought, that is so third grade male humor.
Yeah, it is.
Why am I, at whatever age I was listening to it, 40s,
why
50s,
am I
now
60s,
why am I laughing?
It's
That's
all,
so dumb.
Well, here, it's always funny for a couple of reasons. One, it's just funny because we've made it embarrassing, okay? Who did that? And two, because it has so many variations. There are 100 different, there's the kind of a squeaker, and then there's a, you know,
yeah, I'm wanting to laugh right now. Yeah, that's, I'm embarrassed.
And you could, there are 100 easy, and every one is funny, and you can hear them back after one, after the other, and you just keep laughing. I don't know why. It's not like something that you don't get to hear very often. I think the fact that it's supposed to be embarrassing,
I guess so,
sort of plays a part, like sex. Most everybody has it. Yeah. Why is it such a big deal?
Well, air out of your throat is a burp. It's not funny.
No.
In fact, it's like, oh, yeah,
funny.
Excuse me.
You. Yeah. You can almost, I can almost feel your, smell your breath. Well, can you not almost smell? You know,
yeah.
But it's funny.
But like Dumb and Dumber.
Yeah.
When Jim Carrey's doing the thing and he's doing the flame and everyone's just laughing. They think it's so funny.
Yeah. Why?
It's the weirdest thing. I don't get it. But it always worked.
Yeah. Repetition works too. We tried to count them one time, well over 100, maybe close to 200 running gag sounds, everything from Bernice anyway, to just a sound effect to ladies get in here. Ooh, that's nice. Mm-hmm. Before the joke, that lets you know the joke's coming. So everybody,
it, repetition, you're right.
Yeah.
People feel like they're home. It's cheers.
There's a reason that Johnny Carson for 30 years had Ed, hi-oh, and Johnny would swing the golf club just before they broke and came back with the first guest. There's a reason he did that every night. I can still hear the theme song from The Tonight Show. Hum me the theme song from Jay Leno's Tonight Show. You can't do it. You can't do it. And he was on a long time.
You're right.
Let's have Arsenio Hall's theme. No, but... Da, 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 da. From Hollywood, it's The Tonight Show starring Johnny Carson. I'm Ed McMahon. Paul Anka wrote that song.
Here's Johnny.
Paul Anka wrote that.
Da, 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 oh, yeah, da, I didn't know da. That.
And he got paid every week for 30 years and made a lot of money off of that song. And they were smart not to dump it. I'm sure some consultant at some point said, you know, I'd freshen it up, get another theme song. No, no, yeah. The greatest commercial campaign song, or one, not the greatest, but one of the most effective to me was when Chevy did Like a Rock. That's a statement in three words that tells you this is a strong pickup truck, solid pickup truck, solid rep name behind it, General Like a Rock. And then I realized they dumped it and went with something else. At first, I thought, well, how stupid. It wasn't really them. Bob Seger, apparently, once he realized how effective it was, had the publishers go back and just quadruple the fee to use it. And they said, no, they probably should have paid it.
Yeah, right, right.
Because what's Chevy truck's theme right now? You don't know. What's Ford's? You don't know. What's Chrysler's? You don't know. There are like very few slogans or themes. You know, McDonald's, they keep changing. I still like two all beef patty special sauces. Sesame seeds.
Well, from the
Big
70s.
Mac. Yeah.
We can still remember that.
I'm loving it. What does that mean? I'm loving it. Well, now that's gone. What is it now? I don't even know.
No, I don't know.
But people tend to listen to other people sometimes too much, other people who don't know what they're talking about. They're justifying you hiring them. Mm-hmm. And to me, a smart business play would be you call me in, show me what you're doing, and I'll see. Don't change it. And that happened to me. You remember Steve Mizrani?
Oh, absolutely.
The late Steve Mizrani called me years ago. Hey, Frankie, Steve Mizrani. I said, Steve, you don't even have to tell me who it is, that voice. Now, for anybody who doesn't know, and you're not from St. Louis, this guy was all over television with the worst commercials ever. I mean, they were absolutely terrible. They were so terrible, they were great. And talk about unscripted. Channel 30 usually shot him. They bring a camera in and go. He go, I'm Steve Mizrani. I'm a decent boy. Need your fact. And he's selling appliances and he's roller skating through the store. Right. So he calls me, and I probably could have made a considerable amount of money off Steve. And he said, hey, I need some help. Come down, meet with me and help me. So I said, what do you need, Steve? He said, these consultants came in and they said I need to fix my TV commercials, that they're stupid, and I need to fix them somehow. They're childish. I said, yeah, they are. In fact, Steve, they're horrible. Don't listen to them. Everybody knows who you are. Everybody knows your commercials. Everybody knows you roller skate in the store. They know your partner's name is Joe Ferret. They know you're the decent boys. The reason they know all that is because of the way you present it. If you just did it straight, nobody pay attention to
them. They're so bad, they're good.
They're
and
so
they work.
Bad. Becky, Queen of Carpets, yes. Floating over the arch, or the slime is sitting on the arch. It's hokey, stupid, ridiculous. But the only two commercials that you retain, that you remember, are the really, really good ones. Back to the day when Budweiser, when they did the Clydesdale, those were fantastic. They were really well shot, well written. Only those and the really horrible ones. The only ones you remember. Mm-hmm. In the last 24 hours, you have seen or heard easily 100 commercials. Name three.
Right, right.
Can't do it.
Yeah.
The other thing I used to remind people was, I make my living doing the one thing you are not tuned in here for. Nobody has ever turned on a radio station saying, let's see what commercials are on. In fact, it's the reason they tune away. So I had to make a living doing the very thing that usually turned people off. So I don't want to mess it up.
So that's exactly what I was going to get to next.
Anybody listening, if you have a whole lot of money and you want to buy a radio station.
You got
like $300 million, yes. You don't know what to do with it. Buy a radio station.
Yeah, exactly.
Give me a call.
Well, speaking of that, could what you did and did so well for so long exist in traditional radio today?
Yes.
It could.
Yeah, absolutely.
So because there are a lot of calls that say radio and traditional television are dead.
No, they're wrong. They're wrong. They're wrong. And I know this just because I know it. Look, and I'm going to go for the over 50 and over crowd because they're the ones with the money. They're the ones with the time. In many cases, retired. They can pay for the cruise. They can buy a new car. Not a 23-year-old. And marketing is still targeting 25 to 54, which is a ridiculous target. So if you're 55, you don't want my business? I mean, what? If I'm 55 years old, I'm too old for you? Absolutely, I do. If you turn on the radio in St. Louis right now, here's what you'll hear. Pop music, hip-hop music, more hip-hop music, more pop music, and country music. But if you don't need it for those genres, I hate that word, of music, maybe you just want to laugh out loud. Tell me where you're going to tune. Laughing feels good. It just does. It's an involuntary reaction. When I was in my 20s, I believe it was my 20s when Jack Benny died. Jack Benny, for anybody under 50, was a very famous, along with George Burns, comedian. He had a TV show, radio show. He was hysterical at seeming not to try to be funny. He was just so dry. When he died, I cried. I'm a crier, and I make no apologies for that. And thank you, Dick Vermeil, for making crying okay.
Yeah, manly. That's right.
I watched the little look back at Benny's life on TV, and I sat there just tears streaming because I thought, what a fantastic legacy if all you were known for was making people feel good, making them laugh. Andy Griffith. That's your legacy. You made people feel good. And you made them feel good by making them laugh, because laughing in itself, it's like sneezing. You don't mean to do it, but when you do it, whew, that felt pretty good.
But you can get that on XM. They have the comedy channels. And isn't the younger generation going in that direction?
And what they'll find is 90, and I've listened to all of those. The new one, Netflix is a Joke, is a great channel. And if you're lucky, you'll tune in at a point where you could get maybe the 10% of the programming on all those channels that isn't filthy.
That is true.
And I am not a fan of filth, because partly because I'm older. The F word. Let's talk about the F word. When I was a kid, if you used the F word, and this actually have wash your mouth out with soap, I had that. You didn't write it. You didn't say it. It was considered the equivalent of today's C word for women or N word for black people. Mm-hmm. Now, hey, how the F are you? Hey, what the F's going on, man? It's just, and I have to accept that.
Yep.
They don't mean for it to be filthy, but to the ears of somebody brought up to believe that's not acceptable, you don't say that. You don't write it. You know, my grandson, when he was like 5 or 6, there's a creek behind his house, and he and his buddies go down there, like Huck, Finn, Tom, sorry, they go down, I love it. They go down there and catch frogs, and there was a piece of pipe, like an old section of sewer pipe, and some kid had taken a paint and put F-M-M-K, the word, and he runs and gets my son, his dad. He said, Dad, you need to come down the creek. And so my son Austin went down, and he said, look at that. And Austin looked at it, and my grandson looked at him and said, it's a good thing I can't read. That's the funniest thing he's
gonna
ever said.
He's going to be a joke teller someday.
It's a good thing I can't read. I know, that's hilarious.
That is.
But it's true, and you don't, I have a joke right now in my mind that I would tell you, but to tell it and have it really be effective, it has the F word in it, and if you substitute that word, the joke just isn't as effective. Mm-hmm. I can live without ever telling that joke on the air. I got plenty of others. Mm-hmm. And the others, most of them, I can substitute. Like instead of saying F, you just saying, like, the police caught him doing it in the car. Okay, you know what they were doing. Mm-hmm. He shined the light in, and there they were in the back seat going at it. You know what I'm talking about. Right. You don't have to use that language.
But getting back to the point about, can your show and others from the 70s, 80s, 90s exist today? Is it?
Until our audience dies.
Is it corporate? Is it? They don't. They just want to keep it nice and easy. Let's play some music. Don't rock the boat. Are they afraid to do something different?
Not different. I've been doing it for 35 years.
I was going to say, I look at the success of your show, and frankly, we know this. It's all about money. And the advertisers, right. Bingo, right. End of story, bottom line.
Right.
You brought that in to every station. So if I owned a radio station and you were willing to come on, why wouldn't your show?
The show is free. Station never paid me.
Right.
I made my money directly from the advertisers.
Explain that for people who don't understand. You really, I don't know if you were the only one in the country or the first one who did it, but here in St. Louis anyway,
very risky.
It was unique. So explain to our listeners what you did.
It's extremely risky because what you're essentially saying to the station, when KTRS came to me, the guy who ran it who didn't want me, there are 5 people on the show. And he said, so what are we looking at here? I said, you're looking at just putting the show on the air. I said, you don't have to pay us anything. He said, all 5. I said, no, I'll take care of that. He said, how are you going to do that? I said, well, the advertisers pay me to speak for them. They pay me directly. You get a free show. You give me a platform to do my commercials. I give you the show. And I remember just before we signed the deal, he said to me, he said, are you sure you want to do this? And I said, why wouldn't I? He said, this is very risky.
He wanted to save you from yourself.
He said, let's say you take in $30,000 a year. You got 4 other people on here. You're not going to make it. I said, let's say I take in a couple $1 million a year. I'll be fine. I said, I'm not the least bit worried about that. Let's sign this deal. When we went on the air, I was sold out with live commercials and made, for radio, tremendous money.
Yeah, you were the high paid one here in town.
Oh, by far.
Yeah.
Take the highest paid guy in St. Louis, quadruple that.
Right.
Five times that. And
so how did KTRS and others, how did they get their cut? Did you give some of that back? Or they sold their own time?
No. They owned all the other commercials during the show. Those were theirs. So they got that money. Plus, I gave them like 10% of for administrative paper. I don't want to do the paperwork. They bill the advertisers. The advertisers on paper pay the station. I get mine. They keep 10. Boom. Everybody wins. They have a free show. All the other commercials belong to them. They sell them and take all the money. They get 10% of my money. The show is free. Boom. Can't lose. If we put that show on the air again, and I have to make a decision as to whether or not I actually want to go back to work, because I've been out of work for 2 years, and there are parts of it I like. Mm-hmm. I do. Even though what I did was easy, wasn't really work, you still have to stop down and commit every day, at least 4 days a week, to 3 hours. It's kind of nice not to have to do that. But would I do it again? Yes. If all the circumstances and the way it was presented to me were acceptable to me and to them, because they got to be happy too. Mm-hmm. How can you not be happy with a free show? Granted, the audience is going to be, for the most part, over 40, maybe over 50. Lots of those people.
With the money.
Now, in 30 years, I'll be dead. So whether or not our show would be relevant or effect, it doesn't matter. But there are still lots of people who appreciate being able to be in the car with their grandkids or their kids and not having to turn it off because something on Sirius Comedy Channel.
Right.
If you watch Dave Chappelle, who's a genius, or Chris Rock, the N-word is everywhere. That has to be confusing to kids because we're told, let's kill the N-word, yet they keep it going. Mm-hmm. And it's okay for them to go, hey, how's my N-word doing? Hey, N-word. So I looked at this N-word, and I told him, I said, hey, M-effer. And I'm just thinking, really? And kids hear this, and they see they're successful. They're making a lot of money. Rappers. Filthy, filthy music. And the message the kids get is, here's how you make a lot of money. Mm-hmm. And it's got to be confusing for them when grandpa or dad says, we're not listening to that. Well, they'll go off with their buddies and hear it anyway. Yeah,
that would be confusing.
It's got
to
be.
You know, one of the things, you would take ownership to task live on the air to the point where if I'm listening to this show, I'm going, ooh. He just said, that's really stupid what they're doing. Or you would call somebody out, the GM, the head sales guy.
They didn't like that.
But you didn't stop. So you must not have had fear that they were going to walk in and fire you. Why? Because you brought the station money and you thought they would live with that?
Look, the truth is, whether they want to admit it or not, wherever our show was the most listened to and successful show they had. So what are they going to do? Come in there and blow me out because I told the truth and I called them out? There was a situation at a station where there was a woman on the air, and she did a whole hour on the priests who had molested children. And she had her facts and her numbers. Did you ever see the movie Spotlight?
Oh, yeah.
It's all facts.
It's a tough movie to watch.
Yes. That's one archdiocese. Now, I'm not here to bash the Catholic Church. There's a reason for this story. She was simply presenting the facts and saying, we need to wake up and call them out and try to stop them from moving priests, hiding priests, paying people off. She had all her facts. They called her in after the show, and I walked by, and she was crying in her office. I mean, sobbing. And I said, what's wrong? And she said, they told me that I am never, ever to address the priest molestation topic again. Her boss was very Catholic. And I said, really? Or what? She says, they'll fire me. They made it very clear. You do that again, you're out of here. I said, oh, okay. I went on the air that day and started my show with that story. Mm-hmm. And I said, so we're going to talk about that for the next hour. Priests molesting kids. If they want to walk in here and fire me, do it. I said, I think it's insane to try to stifle a story like that. How are we ever supposed to take action or even know what's going on? I said, so they want to fire me? Do it. We did a whole hour, took phone calls, people crying. I was an altar boy, blah, 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 blah. And again, I'm not here to bash the Catholic. I'm here to tell a story that's an example of what you're talking about. that it just, I don't know, it just hit me the wrong way when they threatened her like that over doing something that I thought was necessary.
Did your owners at any time ever tell you, hey, Frank, I'm asking you, pull it back?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you said, no.
Usually.
Yeah.
Sometimes I said, okay, because they might have been right. Mm. You know, we had this old lady named Bernice who started just, she was a caller from St. Genevieve, and the audience loved her. I don't know that there's ever been anybody who was part of any show I ever did who was more beloved than Bernice. She was just a country hillbilly woman who loved squirrel gravy and talked like Granny Clampett. And my boss, the owner, the general manager, rather, of the station, stopped me in the hall one day. He said, what's with the old country woman you've had on a couple of times? I said, Bernice? He goes, yeah. Why do you do that? Why do you have her on? I suppose she's funny, and I think the audience likes her. He said, I'd really prefer you not have her on anymore. And I said, why? He said, well, people might get the impression that, you know, this is a station or that's a show that appeals to uneducated hicks, hillbillies. And I said, no, you're wrong. What they'll hear is a caller who is that person, not a station. And they love her, and I'm not taking her off. And that was it.
And you never did take her off, never even after death.
Kept her on until she died.
After she died. Her recorded voice.
To the last day I was on the air, we played her, and we played her at 590. Here's an interesting thing. Here's how much people loved her. When I found out she had serious stage 4 cancer, and she was living in a $2,000 trailer and needed a wheelchair and needed a ramp and needed a van, I went on the air, and I laid it out there. Now, I would never reveal what I pitched in. That's too self-serving. But I'll tell you the part the listeners were responsible for. I just told Bernice's story. And in, I'd say within 2 weeks, $17,500. This is back a long time ago. Mm-hmm. So I got in the car, took a couple other people with me from the show, drove to St. Genevieve. Couldn't believe it when I found the trailer. What a mess. And I walked in. And I said, Bernice, I have something for you. And I put an envelope down, and she opened it, and she stared at it. And she said, what the hell is this? I said, well, it's pretty obvious, cashier's check. What the hell for? She said, damn and hell a lot. And I said, well, it's for you. Well, why? Who's it from? I said, it's from listeners. What the hell's wrong with these damn people? They don't even know me. I said, no, they do know you.
And they love you.
And this is yours, $17,500. And then she said something I've never heard anybody say, and I think it was a made-up expression. And she said, well, I'll be SH. Mm. Now, that doesn't even make sense. That's what she said. And she started to cry, but she caught herself and stopped it because she was too crusty for that. Mm-hmm. The first time I met her, she called me after the show, and the receptionist said, Bernice calls when she called. I called her, and she said, hey, I heard you say on air you're going to be coming through this way, back from Tennessee. I said, yes, Sunday. Well, maybe Bob and I will meet you up the Dairy Queen right off 55 and Jackson Exit or Jacksonville, whatever it was called. She says, what time you think you'll be coming? I said, Bernice, I'll call you from the road, and I'll say we're 15, 20 minutes away. She says, oh, okay. She hung up. She was like, she was mad. She called me. So my wife and I pull off, and sure enough, here's a car with two old people in it, an old car, and I pull up, and I've never met her, and I walked up to the car, and she rolled down the window, and I said, Bernice, she goes, well, who the hell do you think it is? Who the hell else would be up here waiting to get in the Dairy Queen parking lot? And then she said, here, and she hands me a pie that she'd made, like a rhubarb pie. Sure, and I like rhubarb pie. And I said, well, Bernice, this is really, thank you. She goes, thank you. You hadn't even tasted it yet. What do you thank me for? You ought to at least taste it first. You might not want to thank me. She just could not resist being mean or pretending she was mean, but she wasn't mean at all.
No, that was the way that she said thanks.
And I looked over at the guy driving. I said, this must be Bob. Well, who the hell do you think it would be? Funny.
The other character, and for people who aren't familiar with the show, I think you'll still appreciate this story. If I remember it right, You're driving through Colorado right. when you heard a guy named Reggie.
From Colorado. Well, yeah, through Colorado, through Denver.
Through Denver. Reggie McDaniel. And you heard Reggie doing movie reviews.
And, for some reason,
you thought, I got to have this guy on my show in St. Louis?
It's Saturday. We're in Denver. I'm just playing with the radio, see what's on. Saturday is, you know, usually throwaway shows. And I hear this guy. And I thought at first it was a black gospel preacher. You know, they got a way of talking, and the Lord said, come, and he's on, and I thought, well, I almost turned it off, but then I heard him say St. Louis, and I thought, wait a second, and I kept listening, and then I heard, he says, sorry, I'm opening the bag of Fritos and Coke. He says, most of you know I'm not really a broadcaster. You're probably not supposed to do this, but he opens it up, and he goes, how can something that tastes so good smell like stinky feet? And he's right. Fritos stink. That's
right up your alley.
And I thought, okay. I told my son, I said, in the glove compartment, there's a pad, paper, and a pen. Yeah. Write down what I tell you to write down. So he wrote down St. Louis, Reggie McDaniel. The St. Louis connection was his mother lived in St. Louis. His ex-wife lived in St. Louis, one of two ex-wives. In the course of the time till we lost the signal, I picked up that he was a 20-year veteran. He was a drill sergeant in the Army. He was on good terms with both ex-wives, loved his mother, and loved stinky Fritos and Coke. So I get home, and I call the station, and I told him who I was, and I said, I would like for you to have Reggie McDaniel call me. So he called me. It's Reggie McDaniel. I said, Reggie, you don't know me? Never heard of me? I told him who I was. I said, I listened to you in the car going through Denver last Saturday. Well, thank you so much. That was his response for listening to me. And I said, Reggie, let me see if I got my facts right. And I ran down the list, 20 years, Army veterans, drill sergeant, two ex-wives, both St. Louis, St. Louis mother. He goes, oh, Frank, you did good. And in his voice, you could just hear this wonderful. I said, Reggie, I want you on my show every day for 5 or 10 minutes. I don't care about the Denver restaurant reviews, but movies are movies. You do movie reviews for us. I would love to. He didn't say how much. Mm-hmm. He didn't care. He had no money. He didn't make any money. Those people took it. They exploited him. They took tremendous. They found it later. And I said, now, Reggie, how much do you want to come on every day for 5 or 10 minutes? What's fair? Oh, whatever you think is fair. I said, well, what I think is fair is $500 a month. And he said, oh, that's way too much. I said, no, it's not. And by the way, after a year, I called him. I said, we need to make it $750. Now, nobody does that. Mm-hmm. Nobody gives you a raise unless you beg for it. But I did because I knew that the audience loved Reggie. And I finally got to meet him. And before I met him, though, some listener sent me a copy of an article in the Denver Post about Reggie. And in the article, it stated that he was dying, that he didn't have long at all to live. And I called him and I said, Reggie, there's one thing you forgot to tell me when we were sort of getting to know each other, that you're dying. He said, and so are you. He said, we all died. He said, some of us just going to get there before the others. And I thought, what an attitude this guy's got.
Right.
And
he was always so cheerful.
I said, so, Reggie, according to the article, you have a year to live. He said, yeah, but what the article didn't tell you was 5 years ago, they told me I had 2 years, so I don't pay much attention to it. He said, and we're all going to go. He said, I'll tell you one thing, though. When my time comes, death going to be worn out because I'm going to give him a fight. And I just thought, I love this guy. So right. He finally manages to come to town, and the issue was oxygen. The airlines didn't want him to bring his own oxygen. They want you to use their oxygen, and because of his pulmonary condition, he had to have. And finally, he got a waiver. He figured out how to get to St. Louis, and I got to meet him. And sometimes you meet people, especially if it's a voice, and you're really disappointed. Usually, you're disappointed. That's why I don't like meeting people. I think, they'll walk away going, that's him. But not Reggie. It's exactly, like with Bernice, it's exactly right. What I pictured. He was fantastic. You know, and over the course of 35 years or whatever, you it's easy to pick out the people who helped me get credit for things I didn't deserve. Terry Daly. Terry Daly was on my show for years and years and years, and he was, and still is, maybe the single naturally funniest person I've ever met. Just naturally funny, but he had a demon. He was an alcoholic. He's dead now. He just died a couple of years ago. My goodness, was he funny. But what happened was he didn't drink for 10 years, and then he took that drink, and that was it.
That's what happens. Chris Farley died that way. He was sober for a few years, six, 7 years. But when I understand, you're a major real alcoholic or drug addict. You're sober for years. You go back to it. You even go deeper than you were before.
Right, because your body is not accustomed to you taking in. What'll happen is, and I know a little bit about this, I won't go into why, not me, but in the family, let's say it's drugs. Your body builds up a tolerance to whatever it is, cocaine, meth, heroin, whatever, and then you're off it. And then when you go back, you jump in like you did before. You can't handle it.
Right, right.
And your body's going, wait a second. We kind of got used to this other life. And,
right.
Don't throw all this on us right now, and you're dead.
So I do want to start to wrap it up a little bit, but I want to get your take on some of the better known radio personalities in the country over the years. So just give me, you don't have to give me a 5 minute, what you really think of someone for 5 minutes, but just a few lines, a paragraph.
Well, first of all, I don't follow radio.
No, I'm going to talk about the big names.
Okay.
And just, you can tell me your first impression and you can, I know you'd be honest, but what they meant to radio, if you thought they did a good job, they added to it. And I'll start with the first name, Howard Stern.
Howard Stern is a filthy genius. Two words. He found something nobody else had the nerve to do or was willing to do, as risky as it was. And he fought and clawed his way from being fired and being fired and being fired to where he is now, $100 million a year, mm-hmm. whatever it is. It's not my thing, but it's hard to knock a guy who's that successful, especially when you realize that for him to be that successful, a tremendous number of people must love what he does. So even though it's not for me, more power to him. I've listened to him a little. I get it. I think what he does now is not nearly as effective as what he did when he was pushing the envelope and walking on the edge, because there is no edge.
Right.
Satellite radio, folks, is not controlled by the FCC.
That's a good point.
Cable television is not controlled by the FCC. If Fox News or CNN wanted to, they could go on the air in the news and go, what's the matter with this effing president? but they don't.
Right.
But they could, because they have no governing body. The FCC does not control. It only controls terrestrial radio and television over a tower. Everything else, knock yourself out, do whatever you want. So Stern, no longer, there was something brilliant about how he could take it as far as he could take. There is
limit. You're right. Now you're
and
not
so,
shocked.
So anymore. now. So to me, it's lost its edge. Who
on
else?
On the other side of that, Paul Harvey.
I loved Paul Harvey. Paul, talk about feel good. Good day. You know, good day. Everybody can still hear Paul Harvey. Paul Harvey was doing it till he died in the 90s or whatever. He wore a suit and tie, and I mean immaculately dressed, to do nothing more than walk into his own studio and sit by himself. And he dressed like he was going to do a cover shot for a GQ magazine. And I remember he was on Larry King, and Larry King asked him about that. And he said, you know, I tried a couple of times to just wear a sweater, and it just didn't feel right. He said, he's old school. He wants to dress up for work, even if he's only walking into his own room. Mm-hmm. With and Paul Harvey, to a lot of people, cheesy, hokey, too patriotic. Nah, not to me. We could use Paul Harvey. Mm-hmm.
Casey Kasem.
I used to do a tremendous impression of Casey Kasem. And I had throat surgery about 25, 30 years ago, and I kind of lost a little of my ability to do Casey Kasem. Casey Kasem was a hothead and a profane jerk, but that's the part most people never saw.
Mm-hmm.
The Casey Kasem we heard
And here's a letter from Becky in Montana. Dear Casey. And he read the letter, long distance dedication. Well, Becky, this is for you. It's the Monkees. I'm a believer. Okay. And they play.
That's good.
So when I was really good at it, there was a band in town called Shaboom. Mm-hmm. They were
I remember them.
A guy that I happen to know who was in that band called me years ago and he said, how much would you charge to do an intro before we hit the stage? And now, ladies and gentlemen, sit back, get ready, Shaboom. You know, there are a lot of bands in this country. Some of them good, some not so good. I think you're going to read. And I just, whatever I did, I'm Casey Kasem, and now, Shaboom. They used that intro for 10 or 12 years of their shows. And when they broke up, the guy wrote me. And by the way, I said, I don't want any money to do it. It's just fun.
Right.
And he wrote me this nice note saying, wow, do you know that nobody ever said that's not Casey? It was that good.
Yeah.
And I hate that I lost it. When I had the throat surgery, the doctor had it done in Chicago. He said, you'll lose some of the things you were able to do with all those commercials. You'll get anywhere from 80 to 95% of your voice back. I got 95. I'm happy with that. Mm-hmm. But there are just a couple of things that to get that Casey Kasem thing, I just can't quite do it.
Yeah. Still very good, though.
But it wasn't so much nailing the voice as what he did with his voice.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's time for long distance dedication. Got a letter from Dave in St. Louis, dear Casey. And he read the letter. My wife, Susan, and I, when we met, there was a song that played on the radio, and I can't get it out of my head. It's the Beatles, I Want to Hold Your Hand. Well, Dave, here it is for you. And then he'd play the song. And what people don't realize was he'd walk in the studio. Those were just liners. He never sat through the whole show. They plugged the songs in.
Yeah.
He knocked out his show in 30 minutes and then left it up to the engineers and the editing people to put it all together. So they'd hand him the sheet and, okay, long distance dedication. Or he'd do it was about 1961. The music executive was walking down the hall late at night when he heard the cleaning lady singing. And he goes through this whole story, but he stopped. And he listened. Well, that lady was Donna Summer, mm-hmm. and she's not cleaning anymore. As you know, she's a big disco queen. Here is Donna Summer, and he'd tell that story, and then he'd read the next one and the next one, and they'd plug in the songs.
Right.
He was brilliant.
Right. I'll let you fill in the blank for your own person to keep it to St. Louis radio. Answer this how you want. The most influential or the person you admire the most, and it can be sports from Jack Buck to the FM DJ to an AM guy. If you had to pick one person that you thought the most of any St. Louis radio personality, can you do it? Is one pop to your mind?
No, nope. I can tell you who I think made a mark like nobody else, J.C. Corcoran.
Mm-hmm.
I can tell you when you mentioned Jack Buck, the first time I met Jack Buck, it was extremely intimidating. I'm not a sports guy, but I know who he was. And I was sent over to KMOX with a copy. Copy, for those who don't know, is script. It's what they call what you're going to read. And I remember I met him. We shook hands. He goes, well, if you remember how he talked, he says, what are we doing? And I said, Mr. Buck, it's 47 seconds worth of copy for Community Federal Savings and Loan. Remember them?
Yes.
Federal Savings and Loan. Well, okay, 47, all right. He walked in the studio. Let me know when you're ready. I said, okay, anytime, Mr. Buck. Stopwatch starts. Right now, Community Federal Savings Loan. You go to open or add your new account, get 3 baseball tickets, 4 tickets, go to any game. 47, on the money.
Mm.
Well, how was that? I said, Mr. Buck, it was perfect. 47. I said, let's do one more. Let's do one more. And why would we do that? And I said, I'm not sure. I said, we always do extra. Just in case.
Right.
But why? He said, what was my time? I said, 47 seconds. And what were you looking for? I said, 47. He says, I think we're done. And he's right. He's right. We played it back. There was no glitch in the tape. It was fine.
Right.
He was right. What's the point? Sometimes people go through motions they don't have to go through. And J.C. Corcoran hit this town like a sledgehammer.
He sure did.
In the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And he and I
don't hate each other. I told you earlier today, I just talked to him 3 weeks ago. He's down in Florida. But there was a long time where people thought we did, and maybe he hated me. I don't know. I don't know. I don't care, because it all worked out. But I think what he did, which I would never do, is he attacked people in St. Louis that you didn't attack.
Iconic people.
Yeah. Powerful people.
Yes.
You don't do that. Mm-mm. Whether you're right and what you're doing, everybody's going, ooh, I can't believe he did that, but I'm glad he did. You still can't do it. But there's no doubt that in the 80s, there's no one, whether you listened or not, who didn't know. It's like everybody knows the name Howard Stern. You may not listen. You know the name. Mm-hmm. They knew JC's name. They knew who he was.
Well, you two came along almost simultaneously because he right. came in 84, right. 85.
I was a country.
You were starting 84. And it's like, I guess St. Louis radio was just behind the times at the time.
Because it was.
You, both of you,
right.
separately and in different ways, really took the radio industry in St. Louis by storm. And it was never the same again because of the two of you. So did you ever consider him a rival?
No. No, because we played to two different audiences. A country music fan is not listening to Casey, and a Casey fan is certainly not listening to country music. Mm-hmm. But that's what we were both doing in the mid-80s. And I don't even know how the friction started between us. I don't remember what happened at first to cause people to feel, ooh, boy, these guys hate each other. Not really. It was actually good radio.
Mm-hmm.
I'll you got time for
the, I sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
When I worked on Market Street, at the time it was, I was on KSD AM and he was on KSD FM across the hall. We got in the Rams in St. Louis and the general manager had cut a deal for the Rams radio broadcast to be on our station, our FM station. So to kick off the season, I didn't know it, but JC was in the parking lot having a contest, and a listener, there are radio junkies who go back and forth radio stations. So this listener called me on the air and said, you know what your counterpart over on the FM side is doing right now? I said, no, I'm working. He's out in the parking lot, and they're having a punting contest. I said, really? Okay. Thank you. And after she hung up, I said, you know, this is why he is who he is and where. I said, think of the brilliance of this. Radio, I can only imagine what this sounds like on the other station.
So you're making fun of him.
Yeah. I said, that's brilliant. Well, now that listener, during a break, calls him and says, hey, Frank's making fun of you and your punting competition. He is. He goes, yeah, what's he doing? On the next break, he walks in the building, flings the door open, my show, grabs Terry Daly's.
While you're live on the
air. Oh, yeah. Grabs Terry Daly's microphone. And I don't know word for word, but essentially says, hey, I'll kick your country butt. He didn't use the word butt. Mm-hmm. Anytime, any place, you want to make fun of me, you want a piece of me, and he goes on, and he's just red in the face. And I didn't say a word. And he stares at me waiting, and he pushes the microphone away and storms out the door. I waited 5-10 seconds, and I just said, who was that? Who was that?
Which,
like,
is
I didn't know. The worst thing you could do to
yes,
him.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. And he and I, every once in a while, we'll bring that story up. But I did along the way. I could see where I did some things just to kind of poke him, just poke the bear, you know, just to agitate him because I knew it would.
You knew how to do it.
I knew how to do it. And he, I don't think he ever hated me. I was never jealous of him. I don't know if he was jealous of me. I don't know. Maybe he could never understand how somebody so bland and so non-controversial could be so successful. Because after all, look the risk he's taken. Look at the powerful people he has to go after to get attention. And how can I do what I'm doing? I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end,
But you talk, like you said.
Oh, I talked to him before the hurricanes down in Tampa. I talked to him before the hurricanes. So you got your windows boarded up and we had a nice conversation. And I'll talk to him 3 or 4 times a year. And he's supposed to be coming to St. Louis. I don't think he was able to. He was supposed to come in this month and we were going to get together and have lunch. So we don't hate each other at all. So those two names, Paul Harvey, locally JC, Jack Buck was every man's man. Jack Buck would stop and talk to, I don't care who you were, plumber, doctor, didn't matter.
Right.
Jack Buck was the everyman's man. And that's what people liked about Jack Buck. And locally, there's just no, Bob Hardy, who was a big voice on KMOX.
Yes.
When I was on the air my very first day, 1970, September 4th, first day on the air, my shift ended at noon, 10 to noon. I came out, I was just spent, I'm sweating, I've been hyperventilating. There's a plant in the reception area, a beautiful, big plant with a card. And I opened it up and it said, "Welcome to the world of broadcasting, Bob Hardy."
Wow.
Never forgot that.
Yeah.
I never forgot, because Bob Hardy was at a level in St. Louis radio that I could never even imagine he even remembered meeting me. But his daughter also went to work. I mean, went to school at SIU. So I knew her, and somehow or other, he not only knew it was my first day on there, but took the time to send a plan and a note. And I just thought, wow. Yeah, I never forgot that.
Yeah. I have, just wrap it up with this one story that's similar to that, because you don't forget that. As many people know, I was in broadcasting in my previous life.
What?
Yes. In the late 80s, went back when I had hair, late 80s, early 90s, working at Channel 4 in sports.
You were on television.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, and I was the weekend sportscaster and weekday sports reporter. It was a Saturday and Joe DiMaggio was in town. Now, if you know anything about Joe DiMaggio, you didn't get to him.
Right.
He was a hermit.
Right.
Didn't do interviews. And every media outlet in town got letters beforehand, do not attempt to go to this function. It was some for-profit, non-profit thing that he was in to speak for at what is the old Adams Mark Hotel.
Now, why would they do that? Why would they not want coverage?
It's him.
It's him, okay.
He's like, I'll come in and speak at your organization.
But I don't want to be bothered.
No media.
Okay.
So they had to do that.
Mr. Coffee, Joe DiMaggio.
Exactly. So I'm thinking, well, Channel 4 is right across the street from the Adams Mark. We'll just go over there with a camera, not to bother him. We'll just get him, maybe hope we'll get a shot of him walking in the place.
Right.
He doesn't even have to know we're there. I hope that they won't get mad. So we go in, and I see Bob Costas. Now, Bob Costas doesn't know me. I don't know him personally.
Yeah.
Bob Costas, because he was a St. Louisan at the time, I don't know how much of a presence he has here now, but he must have seen me on television, because he walked over. We're now inside the hotel. All the people are gathering, and we just saw DiMaggio for about 5 seconds, and we got a quick shot of him, and he disappeared. Costas comes up to me. I find out he's DiMaggio's chaperone.
Ah.
And he said, "Hey, Dave, I didn't know Costas even knew who I was or my name, but he did." And he said, "Dave, you want a word with Joe?"
Yeah.
And I said, I didn't think that was allowed. He said, "Look, you're the only guy here. I can't promise that he's going to say yes, but since you're the only one here, I'll go and see if he wants to say just a quick word."
Knowing it's not going to be he's going to be deluged with questions from a press corps.
Nobody else is there.
Yeah.
So I see him go over. Joe DiMaggio comes out. He does one of these where Costas has his back to me. Joe leans around Costas' head, looks at me, disappears in front of Bob. And I kind of see this nod, yes. And they both start walking. And I don't get intimidated by famous people either.
Yeah.
And it's not. That was the one time. And I'm thinking,
Was your first question, what's it like sleep with Marilyn Monroe?
It's funny you say that, because I was told no questions on Marilyn Monroe, and I'm not kidding. I'm like, well, I wasn't going to do that, but still, okay, on the record. I can't even, the only thing, so Costas came to me first and said, he'll do it, but Only questions related to the reason why he's here. No baseball questions, just a couple questions, why he's here. That's the only way he'll do it. I'm like, I don't care. I'm just going to get to be one of the few people to say, I got to interview Joe DiMaggio, who's not in the New York media. So sure enough, he comes over. I don't even remember what the questions were. I just think, I don't even remember his answers. I'm thinking, I can't believe that I am the St. Louis guy interviewing Joe freaking DiMaggio.
Yeah.
And it was a day or two later, I get
which had to be a feather in your cap.
Oh,
back at the station.
I get a call from Mike Bush a couple of days later. Now, he was still in sports at the time.
Right.
He wasn't the news guy yet. How did you do that? We weren't supposed to be over there. I wonder if Mike even remembers this. And I said, I know, but our station's right there. I was just trying to get video. And Costas came up to me and he said, do you want it? And it, those are the things. This is 32 years ago, maybe.
You don't forget.
You don't forget. I don't forget that Bob Costas did that for me when he didn't know me.
Right.
He just saw me on TV.
He did me a couple of favors over the years.
Costas did.
I wanted to take my kids to see Saturday Night Live. And Bob worked for NBC.
Yeah.
And I called him. And he and I had done a couple of appearances together, so he knew who I was. And I said, hey, we're going to be in New York. I hate New York, by the way, New York City. My wife insisted we go see New York City. Fine, I don't want to go back. But I said, could we get into Saturday Night Live? He said, absolutely. He said, go into the NBC studio. NBC, big letters, you've seen them on TV. I walk in, and I said, Bob Costas is supposed to have, gave us the tickets. We went in and we saw Saturday Night Live. And a couple other things that way. I don't know him now. Haven't talked to him for years. But you and I could do probably 2 or 3 hours on just meeting
famous people.
Famous people.
Oh,
and how I know we say we're going to wrap it up. About 4 or 5 years ago, my older son, who's a huge country music fan, especially Johnny Cash. I love Johnny Cash. He says, Dad, don't I remember something about you introduced Johnny Cash at the Fox Theater and you have a picture of you with Johnny Cash or something? I said, yeah, somewhere. He said, somewhere? How could you not know where that picture is? I said, it's in the basement of the box somewhere, I think. He goes, we got to find it. So he had my wife go down and root through it. Finally, in the bottom of a box, there it is, the picture of me with Johnny Cash. I sent it to him. He framed it. It's like, to him, how could you not think? But when you're doing it and in the moment, you don't sometimes realize what you're part of. You know, Garth Brooks, who is the biggest selling artist ever, second biggest with one exception, Elvis. At his beginning of the peak, he was at Riverport, which is now Hollywood Amphitheater, and I was able to go backstage back there and meet with him, and I had seen him enough to know that he takes his hat off, puts it over his heart, and cries, and I thought, well, the guy's got a degree in marketing. He knows how to play it, and I'll get back here with him, which is just us, and I'll see the real Garth Brooks. The real Garth Brooks is the real deal. He's the nicest guy you could ever want to meet. And there's nobody to impress. He could have blown me off. Instead, we sit down and he goes, can I get you something to drink? And I said, well, I'm not much of a drinker. Well, Coke? I said, sure. He gets up. Now, he doesn't go, hey, can we get a Coke? He gets up, goes over to the little kitchenette, pours a Coke. He says, ice? And I said, yeah, Garth. Yeah, get me some ice. So he does. And he brings it back and we sit and we talk. And I said, look, I'm going to let you go. You got a show to do. He said, Martina McBride's out there singing. He said, all I have to do is take this cap off and put on a cowboy hat. I'm good to go. What else do you need? I said, I don't need anything. He said, what about me signing something? I said, I don't do that. And he said, not for you, maybe for somebody else. I said, Garth, I didn't bring anything to sign. He turned around and he goes, I got everything. He said, caps, t-shirts, posters. What do you want? And I said, I don't want anything. Thank you. And we, Kenny Rogers. I had a meeting with Kenny Rogers and Branson. And the point of these stories is to say that sometimes you're not disappointed.
Yes.
And he had these restaurants, Kenny Rogers Roasters.
Yes.
They're all closed, except in Europe, where there are 140 of them.
Wow.
But they all didn't make it in the States.
So I go to Branson, and I had seen the TV commercials. I'm Kenny Rogers, and he invites you to come to Kenny Rogers Roasters. And in the commercial on TV, he said, if you don't like your meal, we'll give you money back. So I stopped in before meeting with him at the Grand Palace in Branson, and I ate. It was fantastic. I ate corn and mashed potatoes, my kind of food, and chicken. It was great. So when he comes out, we shake hands, and we sit down, and I said, look, I'm going to get this out of the way right away. He goes, what? And I said, I stopped on the way in at the Kenny Rogers Roasters here in Branson. He goes, what'd you think? I said, I hated it. I don't like it. It wasn't good. And I said, I see your TV commercials where you know, you give your money back. He said, do you have your receipt? And I did. He takes his wallet.
Kenny Rogers himself.
Yes. He takes his wallet. He says, how much was it? $6? And I said, whoa, I'm kidding. I said, I'm kidding. I'm just kidding. But he laughed. But the point is, he didn't go, well, you're a jerk.
Yeah.
What do you mean you didn't like it? Get this guy out of here.
Mm-hmm.
No. He was going to pay me. Yeah. I should have just taken the money and framed it or something.
We are going, okay, so that's what we're going to do. We are going to do another show where you and I are going to share famous people stories, good and bad. And just to tease one of those, my idol growing up, and I admit I'm still a fanboy, he's still around, the lead singer for REO Speedwagon's Kevin Cronin.
I wouldn't have known that.
The big, long, flowing rock, Robert Plant, Led Zeppelin hair. And I got a chance to go backstage, just me and family. That's a whole other story how I pulled that off. And I got kicked out. I got grabbed by the elbow and thrown out.
Never got to meet him.
And I did meet him, but I got to shake his hand, tell him I'm from St. Louis. I grew up listening to Keishi, which is what helped make REO Speedwagon back in the 70s. And this is my idol, and it showed me right there, and I was 30-some years old, don't put people on pedestals. Because the guy that I had on the pedestal, more than anything, and I got a chance to meet him, he had me tossed.
His name is what?
Kevin Cronin.
Well, I act like I don't know that, but I do know this story. And do I have a surprise for you?
Kevin, come on in here. And it's my goal, and everyone can hear this because everyone knows I'm just starting these podcasts. Someday, when this podcast gets bigger and some of the bigger names
you bring me on, it'll be huge.
Well, I'll bring you back on, but Kevin Cronin will be a guest.
I think you can.
You
will pull that off.
I will pull that off, I will tell that story.
No, you will. Anyway. And I don't have a lot of those stories, but I do. But they're all brief and they're short because when you introduce somebody like at the Fox, which I did in country music, many to the Judds and Roy Orbison and Johnny Cash and all these people, George Strait, in just a few minutes, you get a sense.
Yes, you do.
Of whether this person's a jerk or just genuinely nice.
Yeah.
And most of them are as nervous as you are.
Yeah. Yeah. From Mickey Mantle to Jesse Jackson and a lot of people in between, I've been really
most of yours would be sports people.
It was news and sports people.
Mine are country music people. And before we get away, I want to say this about country music. I don't really get the new country too much. Baseball caps, tight shirts. I'm in the gym all day. I don't really get that. I'm a cowboy hat kind of country music guy. But I love country music, especially the 80s and 90s. And in my head, the perfect radio show for me, if I ever came back, would be to play two or three songs an hour. And I promise anybody who thinks they hate country music, if you'll just listen to the songs that I'm going to play, you will love country music because it's a story that makes sense about love and heartache and trucks and drinking and mother and whatever, but they're real stories written by songwriters who have experienced some tremendous pain. And some of them are fun, but if you listen to pop music now, I can't understand the words. I don't know what they're even saying. And then when you do look up the lyrics, they're filthy. There's no filth in country music. Mm-hmm. And if I could pull it off, and I think I could, I'd test it for 6 months to a year. And if the audience overwhelmingly said, get that country music off there, they would stop playing it.
Yep.
But I want a chance to show people what it was about the 80s and 90s country that, to me, was the best of country music.
So that's where we'll end it with a call for, what, a couple million? Is that what you're needing to get this radio station off? You want someone to buy a station. What, 2 or 3 million? Will that do it?
I don't know.
We'll put a call out right now.
I don't know what it costs. I don't know if a station's even for sale. I don't know what it would cost. But if somebody's got all the money in the world and they want to buy a station, I think the real money has to be put into marketing and letting the world know we're on the air. That's where people fall short. They'll buy a station and assume that everybody will find it. No, there are too many other outlets, too many platforms. You can listen to music or talk, podcast. There are 1,900,000 podcasters in the United States. That's what you're up against. And that's why I am reluctant to do a podcast, because my goodness, rise to the top of that heap. How are you going to do it?
Beat Joe Rogan and guys.
You need to hire. Joe Rogan's been at it a long time.
Right.
And he, again, is willing to do things I'm not willing to do. You need to hire the best of the best to tell the world who you are, and they need to check it out.
Right.
So you got to have not just the money for the station, you need to pour money into paying the people who deserve to be paid because they're really good at what they do, and marketing it and promoting it.
Right.
That's where the money should be really spent. And most people aren't willing to do that. So,
all right,
that's okay. It's kind of fun not working.
Well, we'll do this again. Franco Pinion, great conversationalist and storyteller.
Thank you for not starting with how are you doing?
Oh, that's a pet peeve of yours.
Well,
hey, how you doing?
You know what John Landoff told me? He said, here's my answer to that every time. Unbelievable.
Yes.
That way, if your world is on fire, everything is going wrong, or if everything's great, it covers it all. Lou Holtz, you know who that is?
Absolutely.
3 nights ago, I'm on YouTube. I love YouTube. And I watched a commencement speech by Lou Holtz. And he said something that he said a lot of things that are true. But one of the things he says, when somebody says, how are you? He said, don't start telling people your troubles, your problems, because 90% of the people don't care, and the other 10% are glad you have them. No, seriously, they're jealous. They love hearing that you're struggling. So I've decided the rest of my life, how you doing? Unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
So that's I love what it. I'll do.
Well, since I am no Joe Rogan, we should not probably go 3 hours, so we'll end
here. How long
it
have
here.
We been on here?
I'm guessing, over 2 hours.
Wow.
So we're into the third hour.
Went pretty fast.
It does go by fast, but we've got so much more to talk about. I will have you back.
Maybe.
If you're around.
We'll negotiate.
All right, take care of yourself.
We'll negotiate.
All right. Okay. Franco Pinion, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening, and please forward the link to this podcast to friends, family, neighbors, even strangers. They'll thank you later. If you'd like more information on our wealth management team, just go to your search engine and type in Simons and Cordes, S-I-M-O-N-S and C-O-R-D-E-S, Simons and Cordes, and the website will be the first thing that pops up. You can also visit my LinkedIn page under David Simons, U-B-S. I'll talk to you again soon on the next episode of the Simon Says podcast.